Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, November 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, recounts from the presidential election are possible in three states. Donald Trump makes another unfounded claim about the election.
I think it's most unfortunate that the president-elect is claiming that there's huge problems with our system.
The American Red Cross is asking for help on what it calls Giving Tuesday. Also ahead, a new premarital trend for millennials. It's all on today's International Edition. We begin with the ongoing drama that has followed the United States presidential election. Officials in the northern state of Michigan have certified Donald Trump as the winner of that state's vote over Democrat Hillary Clinton by a slim 0.2%, or nearly 11,000 votes. That's the closest presidential race in Michigan in more than 75 years. But Michigan and Pennsylvania, where the election was very close, face possible recounts at the request of Green Party candidate Jill Stein's campaign, who already got approval from Wisconsin, where election officials there are preparing to begin a recount of that state's presidential vote this week. Wisconsin Election Commissioner Mark Thompson.
I fully expect, given the history of how elections are conducted in Wisconsin and their accuracy and my trust in my citizens who are counting these votes, that the outcome is not going to be different.
Stein has raised millions of dollars to help pay for the recounts. Now, if the results in all three states were to be overturned, the 46 electoral votes Trump would lose would be given to Clinton and would make her president-elect. But the chances of that happening are very slim. But that hasn't stopped Donald Trump from tweeting unfounded claims over the weekend. He said he won, or would have won, the popular vote if not for millions of what he called illegal votes for Hillary Clinton and fraud in three states. And to these claims, Thompson says this.
I think it's most unfortunate that the president-elect is claiming that there's huge problems with our system, and that's feeding what I call this conspiracy theory. I mean, it's just, you know, I personally, I'd like him to come down out of his Trump Tower and go up to Wautoma and Washira County and spend the time with the folks on the ground that are counting these votes.
Well, Meanwhile, a change.org petition encouraging electors in the Electoral College to switch their votes from Trump to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is making the rounds of the internet and gaining supporters by the minute. As of today, there were more than 4 million signatures, as Hillary Clinton supporters argue that while she lost the electoral vote, she actually leads by more than 2.2 million in the popular vote. Joining me now, Dallas-based attorney Chad Ruback. Tell us about this unusual effort.
It looks like this will be the fifth time the Electoral College and the popular vote split ways. A number of Hillary Clinton supporters are trying to convince the electors, elector with a capital E, to vote in their Electoral College votes, which isn't until December 19th, in favor of Hillary Clinton instead of Donald Trump. And I don't know that I would call it a loophole. It's actually the system itself. We don't directly vote for president. We vote to recommend a candidate to the electors who vote on December 19th. So while everyone in Trump's camp is celebrating a victory, mm-hmm. and many people in Clinton's camp are mourning a loss, mm-hmm. really, the true vote doesn't take place until December 19th. The November 8th election was merely advisory to the December 19th vote.
So these electors, any of them can change their vote?
The electors can independently choose a candidate for whom to vote. It's happened many times before that the electors do not choose to vote for the person who won the popular vote in his or her state. The most recent time that elector has voted contrary to the popular vote in his state was 2004 in Minnesota. It is unusual, but it's far from unprecedented. In fact, this has happened 157 times in the history of the Electoral College, where an elector has decided not to vote for the individual who won the popular vote in his or her state.
Has it ever changed the outcome?
Not even close. in theory, it would be most likely to occur when there are only a handful of Electoral College votes separating the winner from the loser. Let's say, hypothetically, Mr. Trump had won the was predicted to win the Electoral College vote by only two or three votes. It might very well be possible to get two or three of these 538 electors. If it were a matter of getting two or three to switch a vote, that might be doable. But here, it's predicted that Mr. Trump trounced Ms. Clinton by dozens and dozens of Electoral College votes. And I just don't see her supporters, no matter how many people sign their petition, convincing electors to switch their vote. And that's particularly true when you consider how electors are selected. Specifically, the electors are not randomly selected. They're not governmental bureaucrats. In fact, the electors are selected by the political parties themselves. So would the Republican political party select an elector who was questionable in his or her loyalty to the Republican Party? Of course not. The Republican Party is only going to select electors who are dyed-in-the-wool, well-known commodities in the Republican Party. What would be more likely would be if that individual elector had a strong dislike for Mr. Trump, that elector might vote for another Republican. But chances are, if someone is selected as an elector by the Republican Party, that person is not going to flip and vote for Hillary Clinton, who's widely considered the antithesis of the Republican Party.
So basically, just to sum this up, this is just a petition. It doesn't hold any weight. It's just sort of to try to convince these electors?
It is. That's absolutely correct. An elector could be convinced here or there, but to convince an elector who's well-known in the Republican Party, a longtime Republican activist, to vote for Ms. Clinton, I don't think that's going to work. I don't blame Ms. Clinton's supporters for trying. They fought the good fight, and they continue to do so. What they're doing is perfectly legal. They're exercising their free speech right. They're petitioning governmental representatives. I don't fault them for trying that.
That's Dallas-based appellate attorney Chad Ruback. We appreciate your perspective. Thanks for joining us. Well, just 3 days after the death of Fidel Castro, the first scheduled commercial flight from the U.S. to Havana in more than 50 years landed Monday to the applause of passengers and a water-spraying salute from fire trucks. But the wheels didn't even hit the ground before the warming ties initiated by President Obama were thrown into doubt by President-elect Donald Trump, who has tweeted that he might, quote, terminate the agreement. The travel industry, among others, hope otherwise. The differences in tone may signal a major shift in relations between Washington and Havana, as VOA White House correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
President Obama considers opening up U.S. ties to Cuba after more than 50 years of bitter estrangement, one of his signature foreign policy achievements. He visited the Caribbean island nation in March, the first sitting U.S. president to do so since 1928.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas.
The two countries have reopened their embassies after more than 50 years. U.S. cruise ships are now docking in Cuba, and there are regular flights by U.S. airlines to the island. But the death of 90-year-old Fidel Castro and the election of Republican Donald Trump are raising questions about what will happen to the warming of U.S.-Cuban ties. A senior Trump advisor, Kellyanne Conway, told ABC News this week that Trump is open to any number of possibilities on resetting U.S. relations with Cuba, but that he will demand concessions in return.
We remain very firm that when you open up diplomatic relations, as President Obama has with Cuba and Fidel Castro in the last several years, that to get nothing in return, including political prisoners and assurances that people on the island of Cuba will be free politically and economically. I mean, I've personally met, I'm sure you have, victims of Fidel Castro's oppression and his torture and his imprisonment.
Obama's shift in policy toward Havana also has been criticized by a number of lawmakers from both major parties, including Senator Ted Cruz, whose father is from Cuba.
I very much hope that we don't see any U.S. government officials going to Fidel Castro's funeral. I hope we don't see Barack Obama and Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton and Democrats lining up to lionize a murderous tyrant and thug.
The White House has not announced who will be traveling to Fidel Castro's funeral on December 4th. Although future U.S. policy toward Havana is uncertain, Trump likely would agree with Obama's statement that the Cuban people must know they have a friend and partner in the United States. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the White House.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. American volunteer reportedly killed while fighting IS in Syria. Trump's transition team is split on Secretary of State choice. Iranian Revolutionary Guards point a weapon at the U.S. helicopter. And supercharged plants aim to boost food production. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Police in the Midwestern U.S. city of Columbus, Ohio, say at least 9 people were injured in the campus of Ohio State University when an attacker drove a vehicle into a crowd of pedestrians and then began stabbing them. Campus Police Chief Craig Stone.
A male suspect drove a vehicle over the curb, West 19th, west of College Avenue, struck pedestrians. He exited the vehicle and used a butcher knife to start cutting pedestrians. Our officers was on scene in less than a minute, and he ended the situation less than a minute. He engaged the suspect, and he eliminated the threat.
Well, students said they barricaded themselves inside classrooms and offices, piling chairs in front of doors when the incident was happening.
I got a text message from the campus telling me there's a shooter. So we've gotten this before, like there's been armed robberies and stuff like that. So I didn't think it was so bad at first, but I started getting a little bit more anxious when, even in the library, the library I was in was a little far from where the shooter was, but they even made announcements. They were like, guys, stay indoors.
The suspect was shot and killed by police. There are nearly 60,000 students at Ohio State's main campus in Columbus. Well, turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hey, Lori.
So what has been the reaction so far on social media to that horrific attack at Ohio State University?
Lori, most of the Twitter conversation is about the suspect. This is what we know so far. He was either in his late teens or early 20s, wielded a knife, and a Somali refugee. Out of all the available information, his ethnicity and legal status as a U.S. resident caused the most amount of buzz online.
Well, that's interesting. So give us an example of some of the things people are saying.
Sure. So here's what a senior producer with NBC News tweeted. Police believe suspect was a student at OSU, that stands for Ohio State University, a Somali refugee, and lawful permanent resident of the U.S. The top comment to that tweet reads, "Oh Jesus, a Somali immigrant, ISIS, thanks Obama." Others criticize the suspect's Muslim name. Now, on the brighter side, some people did say that just because the attacker happened to be Muslim, we should not be bashing the Muslim faith.
Well, moving on to our next and lighter topic, I should say, what are people saying about Cyber Monday?
Lori, we just talked about it before we got into the studio, and it definitely seems like Black Friday, when retailers introduce massive discounts, is far too close to Cyber Monday. That's a Monday after Thanksgiving when retailers offer discounts online. Many Twitter and Facebook users are sharing memes of going through a tsunami of emails because this is a day when many American retailers send out promotional emails.
Oh boy, can I attest to that. I mean, hundreds of people.
Delete, delete, delete.
Buy this. Delete, delete is right. So what else is trending?
You know, it's getting quite cold here in D.C. with the highs being in the 50s or even lower on some days. The last trending topic I want to mention is cats lounging on radiators. Cat owners are sharing photos of their felines relaxing on top of radiators, and it looks like they're basically melting. Oy. Lori?
Okay. All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The American Red Cross, which comes to the aid of millions in the United States each year during disasters and other times of need, is launching a campaign ahead of the holidays called Giving Tuesday. The Red Cross is appealing to the public to, quote, give something that means something by donating to the Red Cross in support of people in their darkest hours. Now, joining me to talk more about it, Red Cross Vice President of Disaster Response and Logistics, Brad Kaiserman. Brad, thanks for being here. So I know it's been a pretty busy year for your organization.
This has really been a record year for the number of weather-related very devastating disasters we've had in the United States. And on top of that, the Red Cross continues with its mission to provide blood products and blood services to folks, as well as public information and public education. So it has been a very, very busy, extraordinary, intense year, particularly in the disaster area.
Have you guys been just responding to a lot of different things this year?
The past 12 months have really seen an extraordinary level of activity. Just to give you some examples, we've had an extraordinary amount of catastrophic flooding. Catastrophic floods in Louisiana in August, which frankly no one forecasted. It was the equivalent of having a hurricane develop over land, over Louisiana, and dumped just an enormous amount of water in an area where no one was expecting it. And so it really was very much like a no-notice event. We had a peak shelter population around the 15th of August in Louisiana of 10,000 people in a single night just in Louisiana. About on October 5th, Lori, we closed the last shelter from the Louisiana floods. So, you know, again, August to October. And that was the same day that we opened the first shelters for the flooding that arose from Hurricane Matthew, which, of course, struck in early October and affected Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia. And in particular, North and South Carolina saw some of the worst flooding that they've had in decades. So we have, in 2016, sheltered more people and have done more shelter overnight stays in this year than we have done for the past 4 years collectively. So put another way, we've sheltered in 1 year about 4 years worth of sheltering activity. So that's just one example of where hurricanes, floods, wildfires, these larger disasters have really just made it an extraordinary year for us.
This is certainly the season of giving where people seem to be thinking more about opening their hearts and their wallets. What are you asking people to do, and what could those gifts do for your organization?
The Red Cross is a volunteer-powered organization, and it is 100% philanthropically funded, which means we rely on the donations of the American people. And so, you know, we've talked about a couple of major disasters that we've seen, but we really do good work all year long. And so over the holidays, we do ask people to stop and think about that work. There's lots of ways to help. The major U.S. disasters that we've responded to this year have cost the Red Cross and its donors almost $87 million. And that doesn't include the 66,000 home fires we respond to every year. So we can't be there to respond in the future without the help of the public. So with Giving Tuesday, we'd really be grateful. But in addition to donating money, you can really join us in making a difference in people's lives by volunteering. And we have volunteer opportunities. People can volunteer literally from their own living rooms. And we have work that allows them to help other people, and they can do that from home. Or we can deploy you to places like Louisiana or Florida or North Carolina or California. or Saipan. So those opportunities are there. And last but not least, you know, don't forget about the need for blood during the holiday season. Patients, your family, my family, our friends, patients count on life-saving blood products every day.
I would think that any one of these symbolic gifts in some ways would really feel better than just going to a store and buying someone some sort of material possession that they probably don't need or could potentially even have to return.
Here's a great quote, and while I don't remember the absolute perfect specifics, it really says, the purpose of our lives isn't just to be happy, it's to help others. And I can't think of a better way to both make yourself happy and make other people happy and help them than by donating of your time or your money to organizations that are helping others.
All right. Well, we certainly do appreciate it very much. Red Cross Vice President of Disaster Response and Logistics, Brad Kaiserman. Well, there's a growing new trend in the United States when it comes to legal arguments before marriage. It's widely known that millennials are much less interested in possessions than they are experiences, but they're still looking to protect their ideas and education that could ultimately turn into an asset. That left unprotected could be considered marital property in the event of a bitter breakup. Joining me now for more on this, Los Angeles-based divorce attorney Peter Walzer. Thank you for joining us. So is it true that the number of millennials seeking what we call here in the U.S. a prenuptial agreement is actually on the rise?
I've seen a lot more, and there are people that are, and the ages are younger. They want them in their 20s and 30s before they even get started.
Why would you say there's such an uptick in this?
I think that, you know, because the people are achieving at an earlier age and they know what they want and they're making more money and they feel more independent of their spouse, that they're willing to set their own rules and their own laws regarding marital property.
So what you're saying is not all of these people really have anything to lose as of yet, but they could potentially in the future?
Well, they put a lot of money into their schooling. They may be doctors or lawyers or even just in residency, and they expect to make money. They're confident they'll make money, and they've heard in the media from their parents, you better protect what you have. And they're often urged by their parents to get a prenup to protect what they have.
And so are you seeing more women or men, or is it about equal?
I would say right now it's maybe a little bit more in terms of women who want the prenup. And they've invested a lot in their education, just like men do. But for some reason, we're seeing more women who seem to want to have the prenup and are not afraid to tell their husbands that they want a prenup and talk about money issues pretty blatantly and openly.
This does seem to be quite different than how things used to be, where it was sort of a taboo subject. And, you know, one person usually, I think in the past, it was the woman that would be offended if the man would ask for a prenup. Is that pretty accurate?
That's pretty accurate. I think the women in the past saw their role as raising children primarily. Now they're talking about raising children after they're successful and they've got some security before they want to raise a family, so they want to protect what they work for.
What kinds of things are you mostly seeing people looking to protect?
Well, in addition to the traditional protecting their professional practice, whether doctor, a lawyer, consultant, a lot of people are looking at protecting their ideas, whether it be business models, for example, an application that would be on your iPhone, or an idea for building a business, a different kind of model that's web-based, in addition to looking at trade secrets, trademarks, copyrights, and patents, which are pretty traditional. But I'm seeing as a different kind of economy, more service-based, more web-based, more global, and that is an important change. Another important change is it's a more mobile society. So a prenup in California may not travel well to Virginia or Florida, and people don't know where they're going to be living. They may have a residency in New Mexico, but they may be living in California or Pennsylvania. So they need a prenup that will travel well.
All right. Well, it's very interesting stuff. Thanks so much. Los Angeles-based divorce attorney Peter Walzer.
This is Science in a Minute.
1,200 kilometers in diameter, bearing 24.41 degrees.
That's tracking right towards us.
Based on current escalation, estimate a force of 8,600 newtons.
Scientists say that dust storms on Mars aren't as powerful as the one that set up the plot to the hit movie and book The Martian. But these storms could still present some serious challenges for astronauts who'll someday land on and explore the red planet. Local Martian dust storms are somewhat common and can occasionally grow into regional storms. There have also been rare occasions when the storms can grow into a global event. Researchers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory are predicting a global Martian dust storm in the next few weeks to a few months. Current conditions are very similar to those when global storms occurred in the past. If this prediction is proven correct, it might be possible to develop a system that can forecast future global dust storms on the red planet. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States, together with Taiwan, known in the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, or APEC, as Chinese Taipei, announced their intent to create an APEC subfund on women and the economy, which will enable APEC economies to apply for funding to support new or existing initiatives focused on women's empowerment. This year marks the fifth anniversary of the San Francisco Declaration, in which APEC ministers and senior officials agreed to take concrete actions to integrate women more fully into APEC economies. Over the last 5 years, the United States has championed a number of initiatives through APEC that build on the commitment to advance women's roles in APEC economies through compiling and analyzing data, strengthening the regional ecosystems for entrepreneurs, promoting women's health, and advancing women and girls in traditionally male-dominated sectors, including science, technology, engineering, and math, known as STEM, and transportation. This year, the United States launched a new initiative to break down barriers to women's participation in STEM-related fields. The initiative consisted of an APEC-wide research study to examine efforts across the region to increase women's participation in these fields, and two workshops in which representatives from the private sector, civil society, and governments shared best practices and lessons learned from ongoing programs. The United States also continues to support the We APEC initiative in order to identify and connect women's entrepreneurship networks in each economy with public and private sector support services and global supply chains to ultimately expand economic opportunities and regional trade. Sustainable economic growth cannot be achieved if women are unable to fully participate in the economy due to health concerns. To address this issue, the United States, together with the Philippines, launched the Healthy Women, Healthy Economies Initiative, a public-private partnership that is working to advance women's health and well-being to increase their economic participation. In addition, five APEC economies, including the United States, have launched pilot activities aimed at increasing women's engagement across the transportation sector. It is clearly in the interest of the economies in the region to integrate women into the economy. It has been proven time and again, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, that where women are participating fully, the society tends to be more stable, it tends to be participatory, and particularly, it tends to be more productive.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.